Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank all of you for appearing here on this accelerated basis and for doing such a nice job in the briefing on an accelerated basis. It's an important case, and we've appreciated your written work. We know that you did not have an opportunity to reply to the other side, so it should make an interesting oral argument. And we haven't discussed this, but I think in light of the issues involved, we should extend the time to 30 minutes aside. Is that agreeable?
I'll go for 28.
Oh, 28, yeah.
That's fine. That's sure.
Yeah. Very good. May proceed. See, now we know you planned for 20, so.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you have to use it up.
I'll try to keep that in mind. Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. I'm Ellen Durkee. I represent the federal appellants, and I'd like to thank the court as well for hearing this case on an expedited basis because we think it's an important case as well. I would like to reserve, I was going to say 5 minutes for rebuttal, but I'm going to make that 10 now, and also 5 minutes for Mr. Kalin. The district court order effectively requiring maximum amounts of spill at 5 Snake River and Columbia dams should be reversed. While we strongly maintain that the district court erred as a matter of law in his May 2005 order directed at the validity of the biop, today I'd like to focus on the propriety of the injunctive order itself. The injunctive order is quite extraordinary because what the court has done has ordered an untested experiment on listed species with unknown consequences. And at the same time, the court has embarked on a role of micromanaging the Columbia Power System for the first time. In addition, despite the obvious complexities of fish science and operations of a system of this magnitude, the court's order contains really no meaningful analysis of the evidence that was in front of it, nor does it give much rationale for why it decided to order this untested experiment. Now, there's two related reasons I'd like to really hone in on with respect to this injunctive order as to why we think it is clearly erroneous and an abuse of discretion. First and foremost, the fatal defect in it is that there is a complete disconnect between the violation that the court found with the 2004 biop, with the harm that it's ostensibly based this injunction on, and the experimental measures that are ordered.
Putting aside for a moment the details of the district court's order regarding the biological opinion, it seems like the district court determined that the status quo was harmful to the endangered species. Having eliminated the biological opinion, it thought it appropriate to take measures to protect the fish.
I agree. As I read the decision, I think it's similar to what you're saying, which is I think the court said, in essence, everyone knows dams hurt fish. And we're not taking issue with that. Everyone does know that. But I guess what I'm trying to get at here is this. Even if the status quo in some sense harms the species, what we think the court had to do is say that this particular operational measure that is directed towards fall Chinook, that's the problem, that there is something arbitrary and capricious about what NMFS decided would be the best measure to help move those juveniles down the river. NMFS decided that the most conservative measure and therefore the most protective measure for this particular run was to maximize transportation. And the court never, you know, its opinion that's talking about the biological opinion is on a very sort of broad brush legal analytical framework. At no time has the court ever sort of engaged in the science or in the specific operations. So I don't think it's sufficient in this setting to simply say, well, the status quo, there's something wrong here. We don't need to change just for change's sake.
Well, let me see if we agree on what the status quo is. Now, the plaintiffs have said in their brief that under the status quo, from anywhere from 80 to 90% of the juvenile Chinook will die as a result of dams, citing your study. Do you agree with that figure, or do you think, or not?
Well,
they cite, I believe, to the 2000 report, and maybe in the 2004 as well, and they can elaborate. But it's not only just the dams kill fish, but the dams are killing 80 to 90% of the species.
Well, I guess I'm trying to have a hard time understanding why that, where that gets us, because.
No, but I mean, I just want to understand as a baseline. Do you agree with generally with their figures, so we know where they are?
At a maximum, worst case.
Okay. Looked like the mean was about 85% on that table. If I'm all right, I understand your position is that you have to ignore all that, and then you look at operational differences on top of that. But I just want to make sure where we are.
Well, I think I think in the time period we're talking about, July and August of 2005. We're not going to remove the dams in the next 2 months, and we've got to decide what is the most prudent measure for operating these particular dams.
Well, we have a low water flow year. Now, you've made through affidavits, your witnesses have made much of that and have said that during these kinds of years, it's particularly inappropriate to experiment. The plaintiffs counter by saying, when we look back at 2001, if my recollection is right, another low water year, the absence of spills posed a significant problem.
Your Honor,
they're
talking about spill at different dams than we're talking about here.
Yes, I understand that. But
in 2000, they want to extrapolate. They're always comparing apples and oranges here. In 2001, first of all, it was a much lower water year than even here. That was about 48% flow. I think right now the projections are there'll be more like 65% this year average. So in my recollection of reading data, they said this year was more like 2003 than 2001 ultimately. But if I remember correctly, the particular discussions about that there was a reference to the spills curtailment in 2001 might have contributed to some lack of benefits with fish. That was talking about, we've never had spill at these dams at this time. So it was talking about curtailment in the spring and at different dams. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about, let me just move to that right now, is that the district court seems to suggest that what he was trying to accomplish was sort of trying to mirror the spread the risk approach that's taken to the spring migrating fish to the summer. And leaving aside that we don't think you can extrapolate that way, he didn't accomplish that, because one of the things that I hope hasn't gotten lost in this is that the approach for the spring isn't to just spill massive amounts. I mean, we've got to understand, too, the court here has ordered the maximum amounts,
yes,
basically. The requirement for spring spill is triggered by various criteria. This year, because it was a low water year, there was no spill, because that's what the biological evidence says, is that you wouldn't want to spill even in the spring. And so there was maximum transportation in the spring as well. So we have this quite a swing here from in a year where, like I said, I'm just guessing that's what he's thinking is, let's make it more like what we do for the spring migrating fish. We're not doing that. We're going to the opposite extreme. The other thing
is that the primary objection is just there's too much of a spill? Or is there something unique about these dams as opposed? You say it's like comparing apples and oranges with the other dams where there have been spills in the past.
Well,
is there something unique about these five dams? You said there's never been a spill at these five dams.
Yeah, there's something unique about these five dams with this time period. One of the dams, I'm not sure why the court ordered more spill, because it's not a collector dam, but the four of these dams are what are called collector dams, and that is what meaning they are the only facilities then where they gather up fish for transportation. So there's a sort of distinction made between the collector dams and the non-collector dams. But the other reason I want to say it's apples and oranges here is to move the point that for the spring migrating juveniles, there's quite a bit of biological information. They know quite a bit about how not only when spill is appropriate, but the amounts of spill and so on. For the fall Chinook that migrate in the summer, for various reasons, there's very little biological data about them. We simply don't know all of this. So to answer your question, yes, we object to the amount of the spill, but really beyond that, I think that's just an illustration of what we really object to, is that it's really a careless experimentation. We really don't know. And that, and what is the more prudent course is to do what has been done for almost, you know, since 1992, which is maximize spill for, maximize transportation for the fall Chinook. And the reason is that because the biological information is so uncertain as to whether you gain any advantage for spill, and because it hasn't been done, we don't know what's going to happen.
Well, you said that, but I think as a general principle, most people seem to have assumed until the 2004 report that spills generally provide safer transportation, if you will, for fish over dams than other means. And I understand that there are differences. I've read, example, the John Day on when you do it, how you do it, but as a general principle, I think, until 2004, people have assumed that as, with some differences, that's you have the greatest survival rate with spills.
That is incorrect, Your Honor, I have to say. The context in which those comments are made is always, in everything I've looked at, basically, that they're citing to, like the 2000 BIOP and NIMS technical data, is comparing in-river migration options. Absolutely, we agree, between going through the turbines, going downriver through the bypass system, or the third option of going over spill, spill is the best. But that's not what's at issue here. The question is between spill and transportation, and there is no consensus that spill is better. And, in fact, for this fish, NIMS has concluded that transportation is the more prudent route. And we believe that the district court should have given some deference to NIMS's determination. Not only did the court not even give deference to it, he didn't even allude to that.
I agree with you that in the terms of the government's view, that's a choice. In other words, you know, which is better, transportation or spill? And, you know, are the action agencies entitled to rely upon their own experts? But, you know, there's another way to look at this. At first, the question is, well, to what extent should we review the summary judgment that holds the 2004 BIOP to be invalid, right, both procedurally and substantively? Now, if we start at that point that it's invalid, then, you know, everything that plan recommends is out the window, including, you know, transportation. It's not based upon a solid premises because, one, it didn't consider the underlying operation, for instance, right? It just, you know, limited to what it considers discretionary action. So in that context, Judge Redden says that the injunction is necessary to avoid irreparable harm to the juvenile fall Chinook. Now, why isn't that a correct statement?
Because there is insufficient factual support that his remedy is going to remedy that harm, and there's also evidence, which unfortunately has come to fruition, that focusing on the fall Chinook coming downstream and ignoring the impacts on the upcoming adults, you end up impacting a different species, and frankly, the adults are ultimately the most important because they're coming upstream. I'd also like to go back to your comment that if we start with the proposition that the BIOP is invalid, then every operation on this river is out the window, and the district court therefore can take over operations of the river.
That's not what Judge Tushima said. It's the findings in the biological opinion that are invalid. There's a way in which the action agencies were intending to protect or to promote the survivability of the species.
Excuse me, you're right. I misunderstood the comment. That is not, I don't believe that is what the district court's holding. I don't think you can get to that conclusion that because there was the way that the legal analysis was done, or the legal approach, means that every operation in there is somehow a violation of the ESA.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood Judge Redden's summary judgment ruling on the BIOP was he declared it was invalid, period, and it had to be redone.
Actually, he has not decided whether.
Well,
he said he was going to order it, though. It's a kind of a curious line in his order. He says, I'm not granting the relief of forcing withdrawal, but I intend to.
Right. I mean, that is. I think you may understand the dilemma when we don't have a final judgment to come up and talk to you, straight on that we would at the summary judgment.
But that leaves.
He obviously is thinking we're going to have more discussions about what we should do.
Right. But if we start from the premise that the 2004 BIOP is invalid factually, where does that leave us in terms of a factual basis on which to examine the court's order? In other words, go ahead.
Well, I guess I would still insist I don't know that it's factually invalid. What it is legally invalid.
All right,
because it was based on legal errors. Judge Redden has never, he's even in this order, in the May order, he said, I'm not going to get into the science of this. Okay? He hasn't, even in the two, when he reviewed the 2000 BIOP, there really has never been, let's go into the science and find out if, this operation is better for fishers, that operation is better for fishers, flow or something. I mean, I think it.
Let me put my question a different way.
To characterize it as having held that.
I put my question poorly. One of the key issues is what baseline to use, and I guess that's a question for us in a different context. Assuming we can't use the 2004 BIOP as a baseline, what do we use as a baseline if we're assuming that we're not going to get into the merits of his summary judgment?
Well,
we're evaluating the remedy in the context of the background. If Judge Redden has said that the 2004 BIOP can't be used, what do we use?
Well, I think
start with that assumption. I understand you contest that.
Put it aside. And you think about sort of the APA context and who Congress was asking to make decisions about operations of dams and protection of species. I think you have to go back to the agencies that Congress has delegated that, to NIMS and to the Corps with respect to operations, because they're expert agencies, and say, okay, right now, we'll take the assumption you don't have a valid BIOP controlling anything, but we still look to these agencies to tell us how best to operate these dams in the meantime. I mean, one of the things that's really critical to the government here is that the way that we're now going about this, if you have this void, it seems to suggest that the district court's going to say, well, I'm going to decide what the operations are now because I don't have to defer to the agencies anymore. We haven't, I'm sort of in this mode of being able to do that. And we would suggest there ought to be a very high threshold, given the complexity that we're looking at, for the court to start making these kinds of specific orders, because, frankly, this is not a well-tailored order. If the tables were turned and the agency said, in 10 days, we're going to start doing an operation we've never done before, we don't know what the outcome is, and we're going to do it very aggressively, we're going to do the more spill than we ever do in the spring, and in terms of the percentage of flow and so on, and we're going to write a 11-page order and just say we're doing it because there's harm to the fish and we've decided this will prevent harm, I think it would take about that long before it would be declared arbitrary and stopped. And what I think the district court has to do, if it wants to take on this role of micromanaging, at the very least, it's got to give us some meaningful information as to why it's ordering what it did. And it also needs to take a lot more care than this district court did about how to structure the order. I mean, saying, to go to the limits of spill, despite the evidence that was given to him, that there's a lot of factors that make a difference in terms of...
Judge Jordan seemed to have contemplated that there might have to be some adjustments. And at the end of his order, he suggested that the parties should work together to implement the order.
Well, here's why we object to that.
It's hard to say that he's micromanaging the operation of these five dams.
Well, I think what he's in essence done is he said, this is what you have to do if you can't agree. I'll let you guys roll back. And, in fact, because of the problems that have occurred, there has been a rollback from the maximum amount that was contemplated by the order. But what he's effectively done is he's saying, I have the authority to operate the river, but I'm going to delegate it to the National Wildlife Federation. Because we haven't given consent to do anything.
I don't think he went quite that far. But the difficulty, it seems to me, is that he was starting from an assumption that the government doesn't want to make. He assumes that the 2004 BIOP is no longer operating, but this year's operation was predicated on that. So given that, at least under the summary judgment order, it's no longer effective, where does that put the agency? Now, if you said, okay, we're going to go back to 2000 or whatever baseline you choose, and we're going to modify this operation, that might be a different circumstance. But it seems to me, and I could be mistaken, but it seems to me that the district court said, well, the government seems unwilling to roll back and change the operation in light of my ruling, so I'm going to take some action prompted by the motion for preliminary injunction. And under our case law, which is a little different for Endangered Species Act preliminary injunctions, he may have felt he had to do something.
Well,
I know you disagree with that characterization, but that's kind of, I think, looking as an honest broker, that may be what he looked at as opposed to deferring to the agents.
But two comments today, Your Honor. First of all, he didn't give us the opportunity to send it back and say, NEMS, now that I've set aside your biop, what do you want to do? Do you want to do anything different with these operations? And, in fact, we might have a different answer if it were sent back in mid-July than a month ago, because now we've been on, you know, all these various courses and various changes in operations, and they may look at it, and they may look at it differently now. But they have to be given that opportunity. They weren't given that opportunity. And second of all,
finish up your response.
I was going to say, I just want to say, we do not question in any way the sincerity of Judge Redden wanting to help the fish. But good intentions don't necessarily mean that this is a prudent way to operate it. And that's what our concern is.
Based upon the issues that you've encountered after this bill went into effect, have you gone back to Judge Redden and asked him to modify the injunction, withdraw the injunction, to take some action other than what he ordered?
No. I mean, what we've done so far is been in consultations with the National Wildlife Federations, and again, I'll commend them for the responsibility of saying, as effects that were not desirable came about, you know, eventually they would say, okay, go ahead and do less spill. But, you know, and I know that in the various files we've made in the last few days, they said, well, if you don't like, you know, you have to go back for modification. But quite frankly, the judicial process is institutionally incapable of making the constant modifications that need to be done. I mean, if we had to go into court every few days that this order's been modified, I mean, it's really unrealistic. And I think the court can take notice of the fact is, you know, this is not a particularly workable system if we have to go back and forth and, you know, go through this fire drill, let's file motions and competing declarations and back and forth. I mean, the judicial process is it can't move as quickly as these operations need to move.
There is a sense, though, that Judge Redden said, I've been looking at this 4 years and I've got to do something because I don't see any action. And he may have taken a very broad-based approach with the hope of spurring some consultation and some compromise.
Well, I think that
I commend you for talking.
I also want to make clear, we're not saying that Judge Redden can never order an injunction. That's not our position. But our position is that if you're going to take this step, you've got, you know, at the minimum, I think the court really should be expected to spell it out a little bit more, make findings of fact and conclusions of law, give us a chance for meaningful appellate review, deal with the evidence. I mean, there's quite a bit of conflict between these many declarations, and there's not one reference to it. There's not even one reference, you know, I think there's one reference to the administrative record and then the entire order. And that's extremely troubling for us. I mean, I don't think the issue is not does he know a lot about the case because he's had a long time or not. I mean, you can't, you know, maybe he does, but he needs to tell us why we're doing this the way we're doing this at this point.
I just have one question regarding some information. Are the agencies still collecting fish in the barges or transporting fish in conjunction with the spill?
Yes. Let me just tell you what we know about that. Yes, the idea is that, you know, the spill goes on at these very large volumes that they're dumping, and there are still fish that are going to make their way into the bypass systems, and when they come into the bypass systems, they're going to be looked at and they're going to be passed on to transportation. Now, we can give you the empirical data as to what has happened as since starting on June 21st, the day after, you know, the spill started, the number of fish that were coming through the bypass system, you know, they have various tagged fish, and to make this, went from, it dropped about 90%. Now, there are some competing, you know, they're saying, well, you know, it's really not that bad. You're still getting some kind of balance between transportation and spill. I'll tell you, from our side, we think that nobody can make those predictions. I mean, we can only give you the empirical data and say it's fallen off dramatically. We don't know, and we don't think that it's sound science at this point to make these extrapolations to guess what kind of percentage we're getting. But it is one of these things where, the idea of, you know, spread the risk here is, you know, I think Judge was saying, don't put all your eggs in the transportation basket, but it's also not prudent then just to say, well, let's shift over to something that's never been tried before and let's put all the eggs in that basket. Again, because it's happening so quickly, there's no way to plan for it. You know, I don't think that anyone could – what the agencies had planned to do, by contrast, in trying to figure out whether spill or transportation is better, is that they were going to take a systematic approach to research. And you take a systematic – you know, you design it and you go about it incrementally and so on. Instead, what we have is this sudden shift that's made it hard to – I mean, they've certainly tried to adjust the research that's ongoing to take this into account. But, you know, the ordinary plan is a research plan and to go about it incrementally. Granted, the plan was to start a major study in terms of transportation versus spill in 2007, and the reason they were going to wait till then is because they are putting into place these removable spillway wares, so they're changing the configuration, and the thought was that if you do the study now, you're really not getting results that for the future are going to be that useful.
But I assume, and it's outside the record, so I don't want you to tell me specifics, but I assume that during these spills, you've been measuring the temperature changes, the gas, and so forth, some of the other concerns that were raised by the affidavits, and you have at least some data from that to see if those concerns were borne out or not, right?
Right, and I believe in the status report, you know, we've reported on the – it's mostly the TDG levels.
Yeah. We've used up almost all of your time with our questions. We better turn it over to your colleague. Let him have an opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
Put 10 minutes on the clock.
May it please the Court. My name is Sam Kalin, and I represent a group of entities collectively referred to as the BPA Customer Group. I'd like to ask the Court's indulgence and allow me to reserve 1 minute of time for rebuttal. I will focus on a central reason why we believe the District Court abused its discretion and why this Court should reverse and vacate the lower court decision. The June 10th order reflects a dramatic and largely unexplained expansion of the Endangered Species Act and imposes on action agencies a new, undefined obligation. The injunction is premised upon the Court's conclusion that the action agencies not only somehow violated the procedural and substantive obligations under the Act, but also that the action agencies acted arbitrarily and capriciously in relying upon the allegedly flawed 2004 biological opinion. This analysis conflates the ESA citizen suit cases brought under 11G of the Act with APA claims brought under 28 U.S.C. 1331. It does this by proclaiming that action agencies now have some new undefined independent duty when receiving a service agency's biological opinion. But the court order contains no discussion about the nature of this independent duty, whether it is under the APA's general prescription not to act arbitrarily and capriciously, or whether it is some new obligation under the ESA that might in the future be the subject of an ESA citizen suit. To begin with, the June 10th order suggests that the action agency committed both a procedural and substantive violation of the ESA. It did so without identifying the specific violation of the Act which would be actionable under the citizen suit provision. This court would be hard-pressed to discern precisely what violation the district court envisioned, given that there was a Section 7 consultation and there's been no suggestion that the court did not comply with some procedural prescription under the Act, such as in the seminal case of Thomas against Peterson. Nor has there been any suggestion or finding that this summer's continuing operation would likely jeopardize the listed species or result in adverse modification or destruction of critical habitat, what commentators and courts often refer to as the substantive obligation under Section 7.
Are you suggesting that we should disregard the district court's prior ruling that the 2004 biop was invalid?
No, Your Honor. I believe that assuming that the...
As Judge Thomas was pointing out, there's some background and context here within which this injunction was granted.
I think we would concede, and even for purposes of this argument, let's assume that that 2004 biological opinion was invalid.
And as I mentioned earlier, it seems to me that the district court determined that the status quo with regard to these species was detrimental.
But there's two issues there. The first issue is, okay, if you determine that NOAA fisheries acted arbitrarily and capriciously under the APA in issuing biological opinion, which is the basis of the May 26 order, the question is, how do you then go and translate that into the obligations and the violations against the action agencies, primarily in this case the United States Corps of Engineers? The question is, what violation of law? What did they do incorrectly? Okay. Now, there's a couple possibilities of what they could have done incorrectly. First, it could have been arbitrary and capricious for them to have relied upon a biop, but on the 2004 biological opinion. But that would be an APA violation by the Army Corps of Engineers. Or what you could have is a ESA violation. But the ESA violations, and the Supreme Court sort of made this clear in Bennett against Speer, violations really refer to either substantive obligations under the ESA or procedural obligations. The substantive obligation was set forth in TVA against Hill. If something is identified and going to jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered or threatened species or there result in the adverse modification or destruction of habitat, that action gets enjoined. Same thing in Sierra Club against Mars.
It seems to me, although the district court didn't spell it out, that the district court was finding a substantive violation. The district court cited TVA versus Hill. It referred to that. You may take quibble with what, but it may be right or wrong, but it seems to me that what we're talking about here is the fashioning of a remedy against the backdrop of what the district court believed it was a substantive and procedural violation of the Endangered Species Act.
But what was that? I understand that the judge said that there was a substantive and procedural violation. The problem is there's absolutely no explanation in the order of what that substantive obligation or substantive violation would have been. If we look at TVA against Hill, TVA was an example where you had evidence, testimony, and in fact there, the Department of Interior, saying that if you do what you're going to do, TVA, you will eradicate the snail darter. It was unquestioned. DOI was there saying it, and in fact, by the time that it went to the Supreme Court, TVA was not going to, or did not argue, that it wasn't going to eradicate the snail darter. It was clear. What was at issue with TVA was assuming that you're going to clearly violate what Congress said you cannot do under Section 7A2. Can you, as a court, still allow that action to go forward? That was the critical issue in TVA against Hill. And what the Supreme Court said was no. If there's going to be a clear violation of the law, such as a species will be jeopardized, Congress said in 7A2 that can't happen, and courts, you can't allow that to happen. In this case, the judge didn't even look at whether or not this summer's activity was going to likely jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered or threatened species. There's no discussion of it. There's no discussion about whether or not there would be any adverse modification or destruction of habitat. Again, there's no discussion, and in fact, the judge expressly said, I'm not ruling on Section 9. So there's no suggestion in the district court order that you even have a potential violation of Section 9. So where's the substantive violation? And where's the procedural violation under the ESA? For example, in Thomas against Peterson, what you had there was a situation where the Forest Service was supposed to prepare a biological assessment. Congress amended the ESA to make sure that in appropriate instances, action agencies prepare biological assessments. There, the Forest Service didn't do it, apparently in an attempt to thwart the consultation process. What this court said was you can't do that, okay? You can't, if you have a prescription in the act, like you have to prepare a biological assessment, then guess what? You've got to prepare it. If you've got to consult, then you've got to consult. But that's not what occurred here. We have a consultation. There's no question that the Corps or the action agencies did everything procedurally that they were required to do under the ESA. So that leaves us with
regard to the 2004 biological opinion.
That's correct.
But then the judge found it substantively invalid.
I understand that the judge found that NOAA fisheries acted arbitrarily and capriciously. The question, though, is what about the action against the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation? What did the judge say that those agencies did that was impermissible under the law?
Let's turn that question. I take your technical point, and you've made that in your brief, too. But do you think that the absence of that kind of finding prohibits a remedy based on a finding against another agency?
Actually, I don't, Your Honor. I believe that in the normal situation, what you have is when you have a biological opinion and it's held invalid, what happens? You tell the agency, go back, do it right. And then there's regulations, the 402 regs, they tell the agency, reinitiate consultation. And what happens? Normally then, if you've got actions that have to go forward, you screen them. You make a determination about whether or not the continuing actions will likely cause irreversible and irretrievable commitment of resources or foreclose reasonable and prudent, or the development of reasonable and prudent alternatives. That's what Section 7D was all about. But we can look through the district court order and we won't find any discussion at all about whether or not there was any inquiry into whether this summer, whether the status quo this summer will result in an irretrievable or irreversible commitment of resources or foreclose the development of reasonable prudent alternatives. All we find is that the judge said that there was going to be harm to the species and equated harm with irreparable harm. Well, if there was not going to be any harm to the species, we wouldn't be here today. There would not have been a need for a Section 7 consultation at all.
You have about a minute left. Do you want to reserve?
I'd like to reserve time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Todd True. I represent the National Wildlife Federation appellees. I will take 20 minutes this afternoon and split my time with the State of Oregon, Mr. Bouchon. I want to talk about two broad issues, pretty much the two that the Court has been dwelling on already. First, the District Court's finding that there was harm and that an injunction was appropriate. And then second, I want to briefly mention, if we have a few minutes, the merits issues that you were just talking about with Mr. Kalin. But I want to
turn... Before I forget, Mr. Kalin, at some point, respond to Mr. Kalin's latest argument about findings against the action agency.
Let me then just do that very quickly.
Why don't you turn to that?
What we have here is we have a biological opinion that the Court has held is invalid by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And what the Court says in its injunction order, and it's quite correct and consistent with this Court's opinions in Pyramid Lake, Resources Limited, and so on, it says, okay, the action agency can make an independent judgment about whether its action is going to cause jeopardy or not. And if it does that, and if I look at it and it's rational, then we may be able to proceed. That is a hypothetical possibility that's never actually come up in a case, but the Court has recognized that possibility. What happened here and what the District Court said in its injunction order is there isn't any basis for the Corps to make that judgment about jeopardy except the analysis in the 2004 biological opinion that I find is invalid and doesn't comply with the procedural requirements of the law. And what this Court has said in cases like Connor versus Burford is that it doesn't matter whether you don't try to comply with the procedures at all or whether you comply with them inadequately. If you don't have a valid basis for concluding that a federal action will avoid jeopardy, then ordinarily it will not go forward. That's the ESA injunction standard. Now, one thing that Mr. Kalin mentioned is the role of Section 7D. And I think if the Court looks at the case law on this, what you'll find is Section 7D is not an exception to Section 7A2. In other words, it doesn't say an action that has to go through consultation can still go ahead as long as there's no irreversible or irretrievable commitment of resources. It is actually an additional prohibition on top of Section 782 to be sure that there's not something going on that commits an agency to some course of action. So I think that is the merits issue in a nutshell here. The Corps of Engineers does not have a basis for establishing its compliance with Section 782 because the only thing that's out there is that 2004 opinion.
Now, but what's the remedy for that violation? How do you tie that into this injunction?
Well, first, let me just be clear about that. The Corps of Engineers was before the court. We sent them a 60-day notice. We amended the complaint. They were properly before the court. This injunction, that is, the dams that are affected by this injunction, are owned and operated by the Corps of Engineers. That is the action agency to which the injunction is properly addressed, because that agency is the one that's proposing a federal action that could harm the species and hasn't complied with Section 782. There isn't any other agency that would actually, I think, be the proper subject of an injunction in this case. If you look at the ESA injunction cases, the injunctions run against the action agency.
No, but the question is, I don't think anybody's arguing that, but the question is, well, how do you relate the injunction to the violation? The usual prohibitory remedy for that kind of violation is to prohibit that plan from going into effect, period.
Correct. I believe I understand Your Honor's question. What we have here is, in the ordinary case, the court is correct. If this were a timber sale, the injunction would be, don't go forward with the timber sale. But we have a different situation here, and one the court has dealt with on occasion, and that's an action that can't be stopped. It can't be prohibited. The water is going to run down the rivers. It is going to go past the dams. And I think the starting point is that set of operations, and I don't think there's a dispute about this, that set of operations will cause harm to ESA-listed species. And so I think in that situation, what the courts have looked at, and the case that comes most immediately to mind is the one that the court issued a week or so ago, the Washington Toxics Coalition case. With an ongoing action, what is it that can be done? What remedy can be put into effect to reduce or minimize the harm, given that we can't stop the action altogether? And that's exactly what the district court focused on here in issuing its injunction.
Well, we just heard an argument that the transportation of the fish was sufficient for the time being.
Well, Your Honor, that's...
And the district court didn't say it wasn't.
Well, what the district court actually said, and we have, analyses by NIMS and others, what the agencies have actually said is that the safest thing for juvenile salmon trying to get down these rivers is to actually do some of each, to not put all your eggs in one basket, as I think the court said. And in fact, let me just turn to that issue, because what the court did is not, the court did not enjoin transportation.
Right.
It enjoined the agencies to provide additional spill, which has sort of a side effect of reducing transportation, but also the benefit, which is what the court was aimed at.
I don't know about just reducing it. It almost makes transportation useless, right? You can hardly collect anything with that amount of spill. That's what I remember reading.
Your Honor, I think if you look at the declarations that have been submitted post-injunction, what the analysis shows is that by the end of this season, about half of the fish will have been transported and about half will have migrated in the river. Part of that is because this year there was an early migration and most of the juvenile fall chinook actually went down the river before the district court's injunction went in place, and so the second half of that migration will be largely in the river. But that there is exactly what the declarations talk about, a spread-the-risk migration this summer where there are more fish in the river under better conditions, and what that does is increase the survival of the fish that are in the river, and that survival is critical. What NIMS has said, and I think this is at page 1007 of the excerpts of record, it says, providing both spill spill reduces the percentage of fish transported and increases the survival of the fish migrating in the river. Now, that is sort of a broad general proposition, and the agency follows it in the spring. What it has said is, we're not going to do that in the summer.
Well, and their argument is that you can't extrapolate from the spring to the summer. So
tell me why you
believe that extrapolation of that data is...
Your Honor, I wouldn't rely on what I believe, but if you look at the declarations that have been filed in this case, and if you look at the comments of the expert state fish and wildlife agencies, the co-managers that we've cited in our briefs, all of those agencies, all of those declarations, those agencies have said we need to use this same spread the risk approach in the summer. The evidence is there to support it. The problem is that if you do that, you don't generate as much power.
No, but aside from that, you know, there is this, I think, basic controversy in the record about whether or not a spill is going to result in that much higher of a survival rate than transportation. I think there's some people, I think it's the official position of the individuals within the NOAA that feel otherwise, but the basic position of the agency is, well, I think transportation is just as good as spill, if not better. Now, so they're based upon, you know, conflicting expert opinions, but in that situation, why shouldn't the court defer to the action or to the agencies? I mean, that's the traditional administrative review, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Let me answer that part of the question first and then come back to the issue of spill and transportation. I think it's important to understand here, because the government does argue this extensively. The court here in this order was sitting as a court in equity, balancing the evidence, weighing the evidence, sifting the facts. And in that setting, courts are performing a fundamentally different role than they perform in reviewing final agency action on the record. So the deference that is due agency findings in APA review of final action is not the same standard of review that a court is working with when it is sitting in equity and trying to frame relief where an agency has violated the law.
So is it your position that in that capacity the court owes no deference to the agency?
In that situation, Your Honor, I actually think that is the correct answer. That's why we're not bound by the administrative record.
Can you cite me a case that holds that?
What I can do is cite you many cases.
The answer is no, huh?
That is correct. That is correct. But I think the principle there is you're not bound by the record. You can submit additional evidence. It would be an odd outcome for the parties to be able to submit declarations to a court for injunctive relief and for the court to owe deference to one set of those declarations when it had found that very agency had failed to comply with the law. You would, in effect, be getting thumbs on the scale twice. And I think what happens is the reason there isn't a case out there is that the courts haven't really, when you're applying the clearly erroneous standard of review, when you're not bound by the record, you don't have a case that says, well, we can't grant an injunction here because we have to defer to the agency's expertise. You just have courts weighing the evidence and issuing injunctions, and the court hasn't really addressed that issue squarely. But I do think
we are in an unusual situation because the court has indicated it's not accepted the agency findings, and so we are moving into the realm of declarations absent the usual agency approach.
Right.
Do you think that even though we aren't in the realm of traditional review of agency findings, that the agency has not owed any deference to its expertise in terms of the fashioning the remedy?
Well, Your Honor, let me say this. I don't think the APA standard of review for final agency action applies when a court is sitting in equity granting.
I'm not quarreling with you on that.
So
I'm just saying
whatever is due there, it is not the kind of deference you know, the agencies are entitled to rely on their experts. We can't go beyond that. The court has to be able to weigh and engage the evidence more like a fact finder to come up with and fashion that relief that will be appropriate. I think the other thing that's important to recognize here, though, is that much of the evidence that supports what the district court did does come from these agencies. That is, the material that I just read you came from the 2004 biological opinion. The agency has said we need to move towards spill in the summer. The agency has said we don't have evidence that this transportation system is actually bringing fish back at rates that are going to allow them to survive and recover. Certainly there is controversy about that, but much of the evidence that we cite on pages 2 through 6 of our brief, and I think later at about page 47 to 51, about why spill is actually better for survival of summer juvenile migrants, is from materials that the National Marine Fisheries Service has put together and that the other agencies have put together. And what's happened is that state fish and wildlife agencies have been on the National Marine Fisheries Service for years to provide spill at these dams, these collector dams, in the summer, just like they do in the spring, so that we have that spread the risk migration. And what NIF said in the 2004 biological opinion, the specific reason it gave for not providing that spill in the summer is it said, well, we have had recent adult return rates that have been higher than in the past, and we don't want to rock the boat. I think that's on page 1013 of the ER. What's important about that rationale for not providing summer spill is that in its summary judgment ruling, the district court specifically found that the analysis, NIMF's conclusion that we've got better adult returns lately, was arbitrary and capricious, that it didn't conform to the evidence. And that's on ER page 331 to 32 and 351 at note 12. What the court said is that the studies NIMS is relying on to claim these better returns are conflict with the ruling by this court that the agency can't select the kind of the baseline for picking how it's going to measure whether returns are better or not in order to make things look good. So the key rationale here for why the agency said no spill in the summer is one that the district court actually addressed and rejected in its summary judgment ruling. So I think what we have here is a situation where the district court did, and over the period of 2 or 3 years, has very carefully engaged the evidence in this case. I would point out that this court has had a scientific advisor that has worked with it throughout the course of this case. That's the same scientific advisor that has worked with other judges in the District of Oregon on salmon cases over probably 2 decades. The court said at the hearing on the injunction, I've reviewed the briefs, I've read all the declarations. This is not a court that just jumped in hastily and issued an order. It understood and it found that the actions that were going to go forward this summer were going to cause harm, and the question it focused on is, are there steps that are available that would reduce that harm? And it concluded that, in fact, providing this additional spill in the summer would do that because it would improve the survival of the fish that are migrating in the river, and it would spread the risk, which is what the agency has said it should be doing and has never gotten around to do. And, of course, there may be many reasons for that, but certainly one of them is that it doesn't. It cuts down by several tens of millions of dollars on the amount of electricity that can be produced. Now, that obviously is not relevant under the ESA, but it is something that I think has weighed in the agency's calculus. Let me just mention one other point here about this, of course, and that is, as the court has acknowledged, this order is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard for legal error or for clear error, and that's a deferential standard because, in some ways, the district court has sort of the hot seat firsthand knowledge of this case. And it's not the issue is not whether the government can point to evidence that it likes. It's not whether there's a conflict in the evidence. It's not whether we or the government could have written better or more findings for the district court if we'd been asked. It's not whether this court would reach the same result as the district court. It's whether this court has the definite and firm impression that a mistake has been made. And based on the evidence that the district court had before it in this case, I don't think you can get there, because there is ample evidence in the record, starting with some of the materials that I read from the biological opinion, going through the declaration of, for example, the declarations of Mr. Olney. Now, Mr. Olney submitted declarations for the treaty tribes. He recently retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he was their point person for probably 10 or 20 years on these Columbia River operations. If you step back from the issues of which agencies, the sort of legal issues of deference, there's no reason in the world that Mr. Olney's expertise should receive less deference than the expertise of another government scientist who has also been involved in these issues. The court had to engage and weigh that evidence. What it sought to do was come up with a ruling, much like the court did in Washington Toxics. It did not, you know, in that case, the court didn't shut down all use of the pesticides. It said, where can we go here to reduce the harm to some extent until the agency complies with the law? We actually asked for quite a bit more than the district court granted, because we believe there are additional steps that would reduce the harm even further. But the court looked at the evidence and it weighed it and it said, we need this additional spill in the summer. It's what the court called it, I think. It called it a hedge against a portion of the mortality attributable to dam operations. And that's exactly what it is.
Is the first time this kind of relief has been granted during the summer?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the district court also enjoined operations last summer. They were different operations, so I don't want to say they're the same, and I can explain that. But the court enjoined those operations last summer. There was an emergency appeal. The court denied it, and the appeal was then dismissed. Let me explain the difference just so I'm not misled.
Ordering new additional spill.
Last summer, what the agencies proposed to do was actually curtail, stop the spill they were going to provide. And we asked the court to prohibit them from doing that, and the court did that.
So that was a prohibitory injunction.
Yes, and in this situation where you're dealing with ongoing operations, I think it's very difficult to categorize the injunction as mandatory versus prohibitory. What the court did is change the operations, and if the court goes down...
Change the status quo.
It changed the... That's correct, but that's important here, because in this situation, the status quo that the court needs to protect is the endangered species, not the business-as-usual operations. The status quo that is important is the one that the purposes of the statute, the ESA, are designed to take care of. And so the court correctly focused on that status quo and what's best for the species. And in that sense, this is an injunction that prohibits harm to the species.
How do you respond to the argument that the injunction is insufficiently narrowly tailored? For example, just as one of the issues that arise, there are many, that you have the bullhead trout problem below Libby, et cetera, that it's not sufficiently detailed.
I didn't.
The question is, how do you respond to the government's argument that this injunction is not sufficiently tailored, narrowly tailored?
Let me just say first that unlike in sort of, for example, the Idaho watersheds case, the government didn't come forward and say, don't do what the plaintiffs are asking for. Here's something else that would be more protective of the species. So the district court had in front of it our request, and it had in front of it a bunch of government declarations that attacked that request. And the evidence that we put in, we believe, supported the steps that the district court took, that is, to provide a large amount of spill in the summer to get more fish down the river successfully alive and in the river. So it's very tailored in the sense that the court said, no, I'm not going to take these other steps to improve flows, even though there's strong evidence to support that. I'm not convinced that we're ready to go there yet. I think there needs to be more study. That's what the court said. And so this is certainly a tailored injunction. Now, since Ms. Durkee talked about it, let me just also say that since the court issued its injunction, as the court ordered, we have worked with the agencies and tweaked and adjusted that injunction at one of the dams, in particular, to avoid problems with upstream adult migration. There is still quite a bit of spill at that dam that wouldn't otherwise be occurring, but it is less than the maximum that would be allowed under this injunction. And at some of the other dams, we've worked with the agency to adjust the pattern of the spill. It makes a difference whether the spill is, how the spill is, goes through the spill gates and whether it's spread out across the dam or happens only in one place and so on. And we've worked with them. And I think that has been a successful collaboration, as the district court asked us to do. But I think the plain facts here are that the Corps of Engineers violated Section 7 of the ESA under Thomas and all of the cases that follow that line of reasoning in the ESA. An injunction is the appropriate remedy.
Let me one observation. Ms. Durkee said that, well, what the district court really did as a result of its sort of its very limited order was in effect to give National Wildlife Federation the opportunity to indirectly manage the dams. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, I do not have a dam manager hat. I think in any situation where a court issues an injunction and asks the parties to stay tuned and make adjustments if there's a need for it, there's going to be some collaboration, and that's a good thing. Here's what would happen if, though, and I think why we are not in the role that Ms. Durkee would give us. If the, for example, a week or 10 days ago when we discovered the problem with the adult passage, the Corps of Engineers had come to us and said, we think we need to change the spill here, and we'd said, no way, we want it all, we don't want any reduction in spill, you know, end of story. The Corps would have gone back to the court and said, we have a problem here. We need to modify the injunction. Here's the issues. And we would have had to come up with what our best arguments were for not doing that, but we wouldn't be making the decision. And so I don't think we hold any of the federal government's cards in this case. Certainly they are accountable to the district court, but they're not accountable to us, even though we try to work with them.
Did the district court require status reports?
There is a status report. Not during the summer, this injunction. There is a status conference on September 7th. The court has given us some assignments. It has told us to come back if there's a problem. We've actually been filing, as the court is aware, because two of them have been filed here, status reports and declarations explaining what's going on.
But nobody's asked the district court to formally modify its injunction.
No, absolutely not. That is absolutely correct. And it is something that the district court, that any party could do. We could do that if
Right. We
wanted to. The government could do it. I actually think it is a testament to the injunction and to the ability of the parties to work together that nobody has done that. Because this injunction is working. We're having spill. The juvenile fish are getting down the river. The adults are getting up the river. Where we've had a problem, we've solved it. This is not a grand experiment. It is what the state agencies and some of the other federal agencies have been asking for in the summer for years and have not gotten, as you heard from Ms. Durkee. Even the smallest experiment with that summer spill, which has been put off until at least 2007 otherwise, in the 2000 biological opinion, the government said we ought to be doing this, and there were reasons after reason. You know, the first reason was the electrical grid is not stable enough to do this. And then, we've got to put in these spillway weirs. And then, so this is something that has been, that there has been evidence to support for years, and I think the district court had an ample basis for granting the relief that it did. It's limited, it's tailored relief. And it will reduce the harm, even though you can't stop these dams from operating, it will reduce the harm to juvenile Snake River Falls Chinook this summer, and then we will proceed from there in the case. But this court should affirm the district court's very carefully tailored injunction and should leave that injunction in place. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. True. We'll give you 10 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Stacey, would you put 10 minutes on the clock?
Steve Bushong, appearing on behalf of the State of Oregon. As you know from our brief, Oregon takes no position on the injunction itself. Oregon's position here is, the reason we're here is to argue on the merits because the merits have been addressed in the briefs. I'm only going to address two substantive points on the merits unless the court has further questions. In particular, Oregon agrees with the state of Nebraska that you don't need to decide whether the district court's decision on summary judgment was correct. That's kind of the background for the injunction. The court need not and should not reach the merits and decide the merits in this appeal. I'm going to address the scope of the consultation and the jeopardy analysis just briefly to respond to what was in the briefs. And those are the two main issues that the federal defendants raise in their brief. The injunction itself is actually supported by the four grounds on which the district court found that the BIOP is flawed. And I'm not going to address all four. I'll just rely on our briefs and the district court opinion. So turning to the scope of the consultation issue, the federal defendants acknowledge that the scope of the consultation approach that they utilized here is a new approach, never been done before. But what they don't acknowledge is that there really is no support in the case law or the statute for that approach. And the reason I say that is because the cases they cite in their brief, on pages 41 through 42 of their brief, they're all whether to consult cases. They're not scope of consultation cases at all. And that's an important difference. It's like the difference between whether to walk through a doorway and whether to look around the room when you're inside the room. That's a big difference. All the cases they cite are walking through the doorway cases. The Ground Zero case, which they say is right on point, that's not a scope of consultation case at all. That's a walking through the doorway case. There's no biological opinion that's being addressed at all in that case. The holding of the court in the Ground Zero case was that consultation was not required. That is, there was no requirement to walk through the doorway. And in fact, in footnote 8 of that opinion in Ground Zero, the court noted that the biological assessments that the Navy had done in that case to determine whether formal consultation was required were not at issue. Those weren't being challenged. So that really is a walking through the doorway type case. And so there is no case. There is no case in which the scope of consultation, once you're in the room, you don't just look back and look at the doorway. You look at everything that's in the room. That's what we're talking about here on the scope of consultation. And that's why I think the district court analysis of that issue got it right. Second, I'm going to turn to the jeopardy analysis, which I think is really an important point here. Again, the federal defendants acknowledge that they're taking a new approach. Again, this is an unprecedented approach. And as we pointed out in our brief, we believe that that approach is inconsistent with the Endangered Species Act, the text of the act itself, the NOAA's prior formal regulations on the issue, and the ESA consultation handbook that governs the jeopardy analysis. I'm going to rely on our brief, unless the court has questions on that point, and also I think it's adequately explained in the district court opinion. The point I wanted to address today is why it's flawed. And I think that's an important point because I don't think we ought to lose sight of why that analysis is flawed. And the reason is it really attempts to evaluate whether the operation of the dams will jeopardize these protected species of salmon and steelhead without ever really stepping back and considering the larger picture. Are these species on a trajectory to extinction? And that's an important point, and that needs to be considered. The reason I say that it doesn't do that is because it adopts this comparison approach versus, and they acknowledge that in their brief, what we've described in our brief as the aggregate approach. You need to aggregate all the effects, not just of the action at issue, but the effects of the baseline, the environmental baseline, the cumulative effects of prior actions over time. The regulation's clear that you have to look at the effects of the action which the regulation defines as the direct and indirect effects that are added to the baseline, in the cumulative effects of prior actions. You don't compare, you don't make a comparison to a hypothetical reference model. And that's what they did in this biological opinion, and that's the key flaw. Because if you do that, you're acknowledging the possibility that the species could be on the path to extinction, not the path to survival and recovery, which is what the statute requires. That's the biggest problem. That's what Congress intended by the Endangered Species Act. That's what the prior formal regulations require. Now, if they want to change their regulations, they can do that, but they have to go through formal notice and comment procedures under the Administrative Procedures Act. They haven't done that. And that's also what the ESA consultation handbook says. Those are really the points I had to make if the Court has any
questions. Despite your forceful argument regarding the district court judge's ruling on the 2004 biological opinion, you nonetheless take no position on whether the district court properly exercised its discretion in granting injunctive relief.
That's correct.
Somewhat perplexing.
The reason, I'm understanding you're asking for an explanation.
An explanation really isn't.
We do believe that the analysis of the summary judgment opinion is correct.
Right.
We took no position on the injunction itself because, frankly, there are some important issues that you've already heard from the other parties on that need to be sorted out. Oregon adopted an approach to try to work with the parties on an agreed resolution rather than join in the injunction proceedings. That was the approach we took.
Sure. And of course, if the judge made a legally incorrect ruling that formed the predicate of this, then that's at issue in any preliminary injunction, too. So I don't fault your approach.
That is true, although we do not believe that it was legally incorrect.
That's why it's at issue, potentially at issue here. We could say we're not going to reach the issue, or we could say we're going to deal with it squarely.
I think it comes into play in determining whether the plaintiff, and this is a preliminary injunction, whether the plaintiffs met their burden of showing that they had a likelihood of success on the merits. It does come into play there, and I think that's where it comes into play to your analysis as well. Thank you very much.
We'll put 5 minutes on the clock.
5 minutes. Thank you. Your Honor, I invited my many colleagues who are very knowledgeable about this to pass me notes, and I'm not sure I'll ask that again because they've given me a lot to work with. So let me get started. First, I'd like to really emphasize this goes to the baseline issue and the status quo issue and whether it's a prohibitory or a mandatory injunction. The status quo in the 1995 BIOP, the 2000 BIOP, and the 2004 BIOP all have the same operational scheme for this particular time period and these particular dams. The weight of precedential experience says that this is the most conservative approach to these species. So whether and as a legal matter, the 2004 BIOP hasn't been set aside, so it is the baseline because it's still in place. But even if you want to fall back on some of these others, it gets to the same place.
Is there a difference in, I guess, the theoretical approach on obligations here? By that I mean the government's approach seems to be predicated on the theory that one only has to protect the survival of the species. And the plaintiff's approach is you have to do survival plus affirmative recovery. Is that part of the difference in approach here, or have I misinterpreted in reading between the lines of the government?
I think that's how they would characterize it. That is not how we characterize it. In the Jeopardy decision, the elements of recovery were definitely looked at, and in Chapter 8 in particular, I would point to show.
The point is, you agree that you have an affirmative obligation toward recovery. Argue that that's what you're doing. And is that the gist of your argument?
Well, I don't want to overstate. I mean, I think the Gifford-Pinchot issue that we've all briefed really gets to that. We're saying that within the Jeopardy determination, there is an element of consideration that you have to have enough, keep enough surviving that you get to the recovery. But we're not But there is a distinction, I suppose, at some level, in that we're saying that the Section 782 no jeopardy and no critical habitat modification is a distinctly separate inquiry from the 781, which is the conservation obligation of the government. And when we're in this, you know, biological opinion mode, we're focused on 782.
Okay. You better get back to your notes. Your
okay.
colleagues will be just...
These will go quick, but I just... Some factual things. In the spread-the-risk approach that's applied in the spring, I want to clarify that they don't try to balance it out over the season if they're suggesting this is going to make it happen. It's to balance out as you go along, sort of on a daily basis. And really what they're doing, you know, what we're going to have is a whole bunch of transportation at the beginning of the run, and then it's going to be a whole bunch of spill at the... So it's not mirroring what we call spread the risk. Second, a third point is we really want to emphasize, and what's really driving a lot of our concern about this is that the ordered spill has harmed fish. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, your transportation harms fish and so on and so forth, but you also have
to... So why don't you go back to the district court and ask them to vacate the injunction? You've harmed the fish.
Well, if that's what the court thinks, I think I've tried
no,
to...
No, I'm just asking. I mean, you're telling us that his order harmed the fish. If you believe that, why don't you go back and ask him to vacate the injunction, modify the injunction?
Well, I guess we're here asking you because we transferred jurisdiction to this court to ask you to set...
Well, but in the meantime, the water continues to spill as we talk.
Let me put the question a different way. What Mr. True seemed to suggest is... You took a zero-sum litigation approach before the district court. They said, we want a preliminary injunction. You said, no. And have you, by that, waived your argument in some fashion that it should be narrowly tailored by not offering a suggestion as to how to narrowly tailor?
Your Honor, I don't think it's fair to say what we did was a zero-sum approach. If you would look at the declarations by Henriksen, by Peters, Rock Peters and Ocker, they all pointed out that one of the problems with what the plaintiffs were asking for is that it went too extreme and that things needed to be more incremental and so on. The court never engaged in anything we told them. I mean, we don't have anything there. And I think that's the frustration. If the court thinks that's the way we need to go about it, but I think we're going to get in this endless cycle.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can recall as a district court judge, whenever I ordered a preliminary injunction, I would often ask the parties to craft the terms of the injunction for me to consider. You know, if you're really opposing the preliminary injunction, I'll give you a chance to comment on the terms and how the injunction is going to be framed. Now, that didn't happen here, and I recognize that. And you're certainly not obligated to go back to Judge Redden and ask him to modify it in any way. You have every right to be here and ask us to reverse what he did on the grounds that he abused his discretion. But you continually make the point that the fish are being harmed, and you know, you could go back to him on a moment's notice.
All right.
Along those lines, let me ask you another question. If we were to say the district court erred in not tailoring this appropriately, how would we say the district court should have tailored it in the government's view?
I think the court needed to find a if the court was determined to throw out, you know, say we're not going to do transportation anymore, I really want you to try this experiment. Mm-hmm. I think the court should have somehow put some parameters on it that took care of water quality problems that might come from the volumes it was already.
Based on this record, what would those parameters be?
That water quality ultimately we sort of negotiated some of this into this, but we told him there was going to be problems with water quality. And instead he ordered a volume that took that into account instead of saying, well, I only want you to go out, I don't want you to order so much that, you know, you'll see and you cause these water quality problems.
I realize you're in a tough position because you're arguing against the injunction and you have to take litigating positions. You can't say, well, this might work. And if you did this, it would be okay. I mean, that's part of litigation strategy. You're entitled to take a position. But when you're complaining that it's not narrowly tailored, that implies that there's an answer to the question of narrow tailoring. And in most narrow tailoring cases, I'll say the district court should have done X to narrowly tailor. What do you think X is, aside from what you just told us?
Well, I think, if I could switch, I think when we're talking, our better argument why it's not narrowly tailored is that it goes back to it doesn't fit the violation. And it doesn't fit what he never really addressed whether the transportation was the big problem here and it was the cause of the harm. So in our brief, that's really what we're trying to say. And I think that I would like to leave aside for a moment the harm of the fish and hit a couple
more. Go ahead with the point you want to make.
Again, I don't want to beat on this too much, but, it goes back to this deference. Who really has the expertise here and who did Congress expect? And I think for them to say we get no deference whatsoever here because the court is sitting in equity is too extreme. And I would also point out that when a court does sit in equity, it also has its own obligations to make findings of fact and conclusions of law, which we don't think was done here. As far as the sort of...
He has to give a reason for why he's granting an injunctive relief, but does he have to give detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law in an injunction?
No, I think in this situation, it has to have a lot more detail than he provided. I mean, the one thing it might take from the status reports is trying to make these adjustments and running this river is extremely complicated. And to sort of just broad brush and the fish science, I mean, I think it should be a higher threshold, and I think the court should be expected to do a little more in these circumstances.
But I'm not
that simple. I do see very simple injunctive orders, and they're not confusing to people. We understand when you stop a timber sale, you stop a timber sale.
No, I think the difficulty is, though, he was faced with a choice of what to do and given two choices, and he decided to accept one suggestion and not another. Reading this record, even with all the objections, it would be hard for me to sit down and write a narrowly tailored order absent some guidance from the agency, because the agency positions don't do it. Don't do it at all. And that's your position on appeal, and that's fine, but
I think he should have sent it back to the agencies. I mean, that's part of her point.
Okay.
Is that, at the end of the day, it's the fish that deserve more than they're getting out of this process at this point. The fish are the ones that deserve the very best science and the very best passage down the river. And NIMS and those working on all sincerity believe that what they chose is that, just as they do. But I think that the way that it should operate is that it needs to go to the agencies with the expertise to do that and make those determinations. And instead, we have fish being subjected to an injunction, which is the product of, frankly, an abuse of discretion, if not non-existent fact-finding.
How do you respond to the comments that we heard earlier that for years, the agencies have been contemplating experiments or studies about spill versus transportation. And everybody's still waiting for the agencies to implement their study.
Well, first of all,
a scientifically sound study that's going to provide sort of the fundamental answer to this debate that's been going on. How long must everybody wait?
3 points, Your Honor. They've started. They started in 1999. They reported in our brief. They're going incrementally, so it's not accurate to say there are no. We've just said we're not even starting. In fact, this summer the plan had been to have 3 weeks of spill at two of the dams. Okay, so it wasn't that we weren't going to do anything. They were starting. Secondly, in the biological opinion, I think it's around pages 531, it talks about that there is sort of a dearth of research on fall Chinook. There's a whole lot of research on the spring migrating species. It also explains why that is. Some of the problems with doing summer research are that water temperatures are higher and it's harder to handle the fish. And various other considerations. So it's not that, I don't think that it's they're doing nothing and purposely doing it this way. In fact, it is a priority. At the same time, the agencies followed what the 2000 biop contemplated and the 2004 biop contemplated, which is to go through this very regional, collaborative process to figure out how to go about research. And basically, the judge has thrown that out the window. We're not saying we can get no data from this year, but we certainly, the scientists think it's going to be compromised in terms of how much precision we get out of it because it was done so rapidly and without study and so on. So I don't think if that's the problem, this isn't the answer.
So the study's in progress?
that we're all, I mean, part of, I mean, what the research told me is they wouldn't want to go into a study of transport versus spill by just suddenly turning on the spill as hard as you can. That they wanted to, I mean, part of what they wanted to do this year was to look at how these removable spillway wares work and how they can make them work most efficiently. And then so when they bring in more spill, they have some idea of what kind of criteria you want to apply to. And instead, we're just on this catch-up basis, trying to adjust as we go along. I guess the last point I'd like to say, and it sort of ties in with this research, is that despite the fact that the research isn't where it is, and frankly, you know, no one can say with certainty, and we're not telling you here that we know for certain what's going to happen, you know, that transport is always better than spill. What we do know is we haven't tried this. And we also know that that under transportation, we haven't had any, you know, disasters with this, the Fall Chinook. And in fact, in the last 10 years, you know, since 1992 is when they began maximizing. From 1995 to present, the trends for Fall Chinook returns have been going dramatically upward, from around 2,000 returning in 1995 to numbers, you know, in different years, 12,000 and even higher. And that's why we think this is prudent not to suddenly change at this point in time. And I'd also like to respond to Mr. Chu saying that in the summary judgment motion, the court somehow, you know, we can sort of interpret it as an arbitrary and capricious finding as to this trend for Fall Chinook. And, in fact, I think if you look at that footnote, the court never said, you know, no, I don't think the trends are coming up. And it never said your science is bad. I mean, I think it's overstating the case there.
Thank you, counsel.
Got 1 minute left, I think. Could reserve a little more than a minute. Why don't you put 2 minutes on the clock? You had a minute 30 or a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. Unless the court has any questions, I just wanted to address two quick points. The first is there was some discussion about the Washington Toxics, recent court's decision in Washington Toxics. I think that case is entirely different than what we're talking about here. There was a failure to even engage in a Section 7 consultation, and that was no different than in most ESA violation cases where there's a prescription. You must engage in a consultation, and unfortunately there the action agency did not do that. So that's entirely different than what we've got here. The second point I wanted to talk about was that we've heard some discussion about really how the court could have tailored the injunction or tailored the remedy. Well, it's very difficult for either us or I think for the United States to have actually gone back and asked the court to be more tailored, because the court first, in order to be tailored, the court has to understand what the alleged violation really is. Whether or not we're talking about that there's going to be jeopardy unless you change the status quo this summer, or unless there's going to be take, but the court didn't rule on that. So we would first need to know what the alleged violation was so that we could tailor a remedy or even ask the court to tailor a remedy. But unfortunately, the court didn't engage in any of that kind of discussion in its June 10th order. So it's very difficult to even suggest how one would tailor it, because you can't just say that harm to the species means that we have to have some overarching mandatory type injunction, because harm to the species cannot be the standard, particularly when you're dealing with the ESA, when harm is even the trigger to begin the Section 7 consultation.
So, thank you, counsel. Before we the case is heard, we submitted, and let me ask one question. This is a very important and ongoing issue, and we will decide the appeal, but I say that preliminary to my question. Would the services of the circuit mediator help and be of any assistance to you in resolving some of the ongoing concerns, Judge Redden's request for collaboration, or do you feel you're on a good enough track that those issues can be resolved? I'm not suggesting we're going to delay our decision one bit because of that. But that's something you may want to talk about and then get back to us on. The circuit mediator's office is very effective. It may be of some assistance given the complexity of this case. They have an excellent record in environmental cases because they have the ability to bring non-parties in. So that's a suggestion. If you want to make use of that, I'll just ask you to let us know. And I'm emphasizing that it makes no difference to us in the current context. We understand that we have to decide this preliminary injunction appeal. But if it is of assistance to you going forward in trying to resolve some of the issues that Judge Redden asked you to resolve before the September conference or even ongoing, I think we would be happy to issue an order referring, at least to asking the circuit mediator to assist you. That being said, thank you all again for your excellent presentations, and we are in recess.
All rise.